With Art Blakey, you formed the original Jazz Messengers. What led you and Blakey to form this seminal jazz band?
Well, it was just something that occurred, Chris. I'll tell you how it occurred. I had made a couple of records with Lou Donaldson for Blue Note, you know, as his pianist on the records. We made two albums, and then we were about to make a third, and something happened, and Lou, I don't know if he was sick or he canceled out or something, and Alfred Lyons from Blue Note called me and said, well, look, Lou, we got the studio reserved, and Lou can't make it. Come on and make a trio album for me, you know. So I went and I made a trio album for him, and then I made a second trio album for him. Then he asked me to make a third trio album, and I said, well, look, this time I'd like to use some horns, you know. He said, well, okay, who do you want to use? I said, well, I'd like to use Kenny Durham on trumpet and Hank Mobley on tenor, and Art Blakey on drums and Doug Watkins on bass and myself, you know. So he said, okay. So we got together, we rehearsed, and we made a record, and it came out quite well, and we made a second one. We made a 10-inch vinyl at that time. They didn't have the 12 inches out as of yet. We did a 10-inch vinyl, and we did a second 10-inch vinyl. And in doing those two recordings, we realized that we sounded good together. You know, we gelled together. We were compatible with each other musically. And we said, hey, we sound good together. We ought to stick together and try to make a go of it, you know, make a group out of it. And that's how the Jazz Messenger started, you know, because it started from my making those two 10-inch vinyls. They were called Horace Silver Quintet. They were the records that had Doodlin' on it and The Preacher, you know, those tunes, mm-hmm. Rum 608.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what started it off, because it started as just a put together session for a date that I was doing with horns, and we just thought we sounded so good together, and we gelled so well together that we decided to try to make a go of it out of it, and so we called the group the Jazz Messengers.
You mentioned musicians being able to play funky and hip. Could you tell us for the listeners' sake, what's the difference between funky and hip?
Well, that's very hard to explain verbally. A funky connotation means a bluesy approach. You know, you approach something with a bluesy concept to it. You know, when you're soloing. Hip is a little more intellectual concept. It's a little more a sophisticated concept. A little more intricate. That's as close as I can come to describing it.
Well, that's fine.
It's very difficult to describe.
Well,
you just have to feel it. You know?
Yeah, that's fine. You were associated, of course, with Blue Note Records for more than 25 years. You were also a close friend of Alfred Lyon, who was the catalyst behind that label. What was it like to work in one of the best jazz record companies, and could you tell us about your association with Alfred Lyon?
Well, we had a very good association. We got along well together. And what I liked about, I guess one reason why I stayed there so long is because they let me do my thing, you know. A lot of companies would try to talk you into going into another direction with your music, or they would try to influence you as to what musicians to use on the session, or what tunes you should record. Blue Note always let me do my thing. You know, I picked my own musicians and I wrote my own music and recorded what I wanted to record. And they never bothered me about that. They never said, well, look, why don't you record Stardust or something, or why don't you record Body and Soul or something? You know, they are great tunes, but I had my own tunes that I wanted to do. And they never questioned that, you know. They never said, well, why don't you use this musician or that musician? You know, I picked the ones that I wanted to use, and I could do my own thing there. I had freedom, so that's one reason I stayed there so long.
Eddie Harris died 2 years ago in 1996. He was a saxophonist who, besides working with you on the albums It's Got to Be Funky and Pencil Pack and Papa, added immeasurably to jazz. He was a pioneer in the use of electronics with jazz instruments, and he was also a jazz rock pioneer. When this is the case, why do you think Eddie hasn't gotten more appreciation for his contributions?
You made a good point there, Chris. I really believe that Eddie should have gotten a lot more recognition than what he has received, you know. He was a pioneer in all those things that you spoke about there. He's a great guy and a wonderful musician, a very creative musician. He's always coming up with something different, something unique, you know, always. And it's a shame he didn't get the recognition he deserved, you know. But I think because of his commercial successes, he's had a few big hit records, you know, commercial successes. A lot of people maybe didn't pay attention to the serious side of Eddie Harris because he could really play some, he could get down into those changes and play some really good horn, you know, when it comes to straight-ahead jazz. A lot of people maybe thought of him just as a commercial hit maker, you know, and kind of passed over him and rather than looking at his really true, his true capabilities that he could really get into the straight-ahead jazz also. So that could be a possibility why he maybe didn't receive as much recognition. I don't know. I know he was a good friend of mine, and I know it bothered him a lot that a lot of people thought of him as just a commercial player, you know. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I mean, he could do more than just that. You know, he made a few hit records and he could play commercially, but he could play a very, very good straight ahead jazz too, you know, and get down into the pocket and cook, you know. And he wrote well, you know, and played well and always was coming up with some unique concept. So, I love him and I love his talent. And, it's a shame he hasn't got the recognition he deserves, but, that's the way it goes sometimes.
In the 1970s, you made a series of albums titled United States of Mind and then made a 10-year commitment to your spiritually uplifting music along those lines. What served as the catalyst for your metaphysical beliefs, and would you care to give us a brief sketch of those beliefs?
Well, I tell you who turned me on to metaphysics a long time ago was a guy named Benny Maupin, tenor saxophone player that played with my band for a while. We had a few things in common, you know, outside of jazz music. He was a vegetarian at the time, you know, and I was a vegetarian at the time also. I'm a sort of like a semi-vegetarian now. I don't know if he's strict vegetarian, but we were both strict vegetarians at that time when he came into the band. So we used to hang out a lot together on the road. We used to go to health food restaurants and to seek out vegetarian meals, you know, while we're on the road rather than eating meat and stuff like that. And he turned me on to some metaphysical literature, which really opened up my head to a different way of thinking. And up until that point, I was my religious concepts were rather dogmatic until I got he introduced me to this metaphysical literature, and it kind of opened my head to a different outlook, a different religious outlook, you know, a non-dogmatic outlook. And I became very excited about studying that concept, and I would go to the metaphysical bookstore maybe every 2-3 weeks or so and buy a new book and study it and read it, you know, and absorb it and try to absorb it anyway. And it just eventually crept into my music. You know, I started to write the United States of Mind, expressing a lot of these new thoughts and principles that like, I had accepted and that I thought were doing me a lot of good. And I wanted to kind of share that with my fans out there, you know. I guess that's how I got into it, you know.
I see. Are those United States of Mind albums in print at this time?
They're not. I'm sorry to say. It's a three-part thing, you know, a three-part work. Phase one is called That Healing Feeling. Phase two is called Total Response. And phase three is called All, A-L-L. But now I discovered that in Japan they have released two of those phases. They've released... number one, That Healing Feeling, Volume 1, you know, Phase 1, that one is out on a CD in Japan. And also Total Response is out in Japan, I believe, on CD. But the third one is not out in Japan on a CD. And none of them are released here in this country. Now, I happened to go into one of the records. I don't know if I got it when I was in New York, visiting New York, or whether I bought it out here in Los Angeles. But I happened to, in Tower Records, or one of those big record stores, I found these Japanese imports, so I bought them on CD, you know, the Healing Feeling and Total Response. But I didn't see the Japanese, I don't think the Japanese put out the third volume, Phase 3, which is called All. But now here in this country, they haven't released them at all. They haven't released Phase 1, 2, or 3 on CDs in the United States of America. But in Japan, you can get them. At least you can get two of the phases anyway. I wish they would release it, because I think there's some beautiful songs on there and some beautiful lyrics and nice performances, too. You know, some good singing and some good solo playing by some of the instrumentalists.
Along the lines of metaphysics, why do you think that music can be a healing force?
Well, it can assist. You know, I thoroughly believe that music is a great assister in the healing force, you know, because it can divert your attention for a few moments. Sometimes you get so stressful when you're sick, you know, and so despondent sometimes when things ain't going right or if you're not feeling right. And the music can lift your spirits up, you know, and take your mind off yourself for a minute, and you forget your aches and pains, and it can give you a few minutes relaxation and remove your stress. And you know, and stress is by and large the cause of a lot of our physical problems. So if we can relieve stress, we can help relieve some of the physical problems that go along with it, you know. But I believe in doctors, most definitely, and I believe in all the healing arts, chiropractic, allopathic, homeopathic, and all kinds of the healing arts I believe in. But I believe that music should go along with them to assist them, you know, because I think it's a great assister and enhancer to go along with the doctor's treatments or the physiotherapy or whatever you're getting.
On your new album, A Prescription for the Blues, which song do you think embodies the essence of the healing process?
Well, I would hope that all of them would, Chris. But I tell you, if you'll notice on the liner notes there in the little booklet in the album, mm-hmm. the title song, A Prescription for the Blues, has a lyric. Now, in that lyric, I listed all of the seven approaches to trying to get better when you're sick, you know, when you're trying to achieve a healing situation, you know. I listed them all there, and that's in the lyric. So I would say that one, first of all, but I would hope all of them would have a healing effect on people and an upliftment, you know, to wipe away their stress and get them on the right track emotionally and so that their doctors can handle the physical part of it, you know. But the music is, I think, is very important to go along with your medication or whatever, you know, listening to some music every day and let that music just bathe yourself, so to speak, in that those musical sounds and let it absorb you and you absorb it. It can do a hell of a lot for you, I believe. But those lyrics to the Prescription of the Blues have the seven principles, which I've studied in my metaphysical studies. I've studied those things, you know, so I know these are the things that a lot of the healing people like Norman Vincent Peale, who was a great teacher and healer, these are some of the principles he talked about and some of the principles that some of the other religious or metaphysical teachers talk about in approaching healing, you know. So if you check that out, that's a start.
On the new album, the Brecker Brothers join you. They performed with you and your band in the 1970s. What do they add most to the brand new album?
Well, I'm saying this, and also some of my friends have told me this too, you know, that this new album is sort of a mixture of the old and the new. You know, we've gone back on this new album to the old quintet concept, and we've got most of the players that I have on this new album are some of the older guys that I've played with, like the Brecker Brothers. They worked for me, as you said, in the late 60s, early 70s, and Lewis Hayes on drums, Ron Carter, you know. We've gone back to the old concept, but the music is a little different. You know, it's what can I say? It's different, and it isn't different. If you know what I mean, it's Horace Silver. It's still Horace Silver. It's still my style, but there's some different little things thrown in there. You know, that weren't in the early Horace Silver Quintet recordings. So it's a kind of a blend of old and new. You know, we got some of the older guys playing with us on the record, and they're cooking. You know, I always, you know, when I had the Brecker Brothers with me, they played with me, I guess, for about a year, year and a half, something like that. And it was a period of time in my career that I was not signed up with a record company. I Alfred Lyons had sold the record company by that time, and I was having problems with the new people trying to negotiate a contract that I felt comfortable with. And so I didn't have a contract for maybe about a year or more. And that was a period of time they played with me. And the only time I used them on a record partially. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that I wanted to do more recording with the Brecker Brothers because I really loved the way they play, you know. And it was so good to get back with them together again, you know, get back with them and do something and do a full album with them, you know. And they played their butts off on this album, too. I really dug what they did on the album. You know, they did a great job.
Yeah, they really did. You mentioned the name again of Alfred Lion. In my notes, I came upon the fact that he went into seclusion. Could you tell us why he did that?
Well, his health was bad. His health was poorly, and he had worked so many years, I think, in you know, the music business is a stressful business, and especially the recording business, and it affected his nerves, and his health was kind of failing on him, and he decided he was going to just cool it, you know, and take a break. Him and his wife moved to Mexico, and they stayed there for quite a few years before they came back into this country. So that's why he gave it up, you know, and sold the business, because his health was failing.
And after that time, did Blue Note, temporarily at least, and this is just memory now, I'm working off memory, cease to exist as a recording entity?
Oh, no. No, it kept right on. He sold it, you know, and they kept it moving. It kept right on. They kept on recording.
Okay. Well, that fills in a few gaps.
George Butler took over, you know, when Alfred sold the company. Well, Alfred sold the company, and his partner, Frank Wolf, was still there. Alfred had retired, and Frank was still working with the new owners. And then Frank died. But before Frank died, George Butler came in and was working there also. And he was handling me. George Butler was handling me at that time and producing my records.
Well, that's very helpful in filling in the gaps of my understanding of that label, because not too long ago I watched a TV documentary on Blue Note, and I found it very intriguing, and I'm glad that you could share with me some more information on that. You played with Lester Young when your career was taking off. On your new release, you have a song entitled "Whenever Lester Plays the Blues." How has the president of the tenor saxophone influenced you?
Well, I used to play the tenor saxophone, you know, and he inspired me to do so. My first major instrument was always the piano. I started taking piano lessons first of all. Later on, when I got to be in my mid-teens, I took up the tenor saxophone when I was in high school. And the reason why I took it up is because Lester inspired me to do so. You know, I loved his playing so much, I wanted to play the tenor also. And I got a tenor, and I used to practice with all his records every day. I'd try to practice with his records and try to copy his sound and his style and all of that, you know. And it was quite a thrill later on in life when I got to be older, when I got to be a man in my early 20s and got a chance to play piano for him. You know, it was quite a dream come true. I never dreamt I would be ever playing with my idol, you know.
You say on the liner notes for this song that you believe that Lester Young exists in another reality or in another time, in another place. Would you care to expand upon that?
Well, I believe in life eternal. I believe in life after death, you know. Nothing dies but the body. The spirit lives on. You know, I am not a body. I only exist in the body. The body is a vehicle that I express myself through on the earth plane, because that's the way it's arranged here. God has made it that way. But in reality, I am not this body that I am in. I'm a spirit, and I'm a mind. I'm a mind and a spirit in this body. So I'll never die, you know, because I don't die, because I am not the body. My body will die. All of our bodies will die, but we live on as spirit and as mind, and we go to another dimension, another world. There's many bodies. There's bodies within bodies, you know. So when we shed this body, we take on a lighter body, one that cannot be seen by the physical eye. Only psychics can see them, you know, people who have that gift.
Yes.
But we move on to another level, to another plane, to another existence, a higher existence than what we are now. We grow. We're always growing.
Ron Carter and Lewis Hayes initially worked with you in the 1950s. Hayes, of course, was a member of the band you put together right after your time with the Jazz Messengers. What, in your opinion, do these two jazz giants bring to your new release?
Well, Lewis Hayes is one hell of a fine drummer. You know, he sure can swing. He's got a cymbal beat that is so beautiful. It just uplifts you, you know, and uplifts the music, you know. I've always loved playing with him because he's so relaxed to play with him. He's got such a good groove, you know. And now Ron Carter, you can always depend on him to lay it down for you. He always plays the right notes and he always swings and he's got a nice sound and he's always cooperative, you know. When we're doing a session, he's always trying his best to give you what you want, trying to bring out of the music what you want to bring out of it, you know. And that's very important, you know, that the guys you use on a session, they're there to shine themselves. You know, they want to show themselves off, and I want to have them show themselves off as soloists. But also we got to think about the whole total concept of the record and try to portray the music in the way that I envision it, you know, because it's given to me by God, I get certain interpretations in my head as the way this music should be interpreted. And I have to explain it to the musicians, and then they have to try their best to give me what I'm hearing in my head, you know. And Ron is one of those kind of guys, you know. And most of the guys I use are like that, you know. Eddie was like that too, and Eddie Harris, he would always ask me, "Well, Horace, what do you want me to do on this tune? How do you want me to interpret this? And what kind of feeling you want in this, you know?" And Red Holloway too, you know. When we did this record, It's Got to Be Funky. There was a tune on there called Little Mama, you know, and Red Holloway came to me and said, "Horace, how do you want me to play on this particular tune? Do you want Little Pretty Mama or Little Funky Mama?" You know, I said, "Well, I want a Little Funky Mama." So that's what he gave me, a Little Funky Mama. That's the kind of solo he played, you know. So those things are very important, you know, when you, if I'm going to do a record as a sideman with somebody, I want to take on the attitude of, well, what does this guy want of me on this record? You know, what is he trying to do with his music? What is he trying to bring through? And how can I help him to bring out what he's hearing in his head, you know, that the music will come out successfully and the way he wants it to be portrayed, you know? Yeah, that's the concept you have to work with when you're working together to do an album.
Are there any tunes in particular on this new album where Ron and Lewis really shine?
Well, I can't think of any one in particular. They shine throughout, I think, in my opinion. You know, they shine throughout because they swing throughout, and they're consistent throughout. You know, they're not playing good on one track and not so good on another. They're playing good on every track. So I can't say that they play any better on any one track than the other. That they play good on everything on there. They satisfy me. They gave me what I wanted. You know.
Well, that's great. On the tune "Sunrise in Malibu," I was listening to it and I was looking at the brief liner notes for it, and I couldn't help think about how the physical changes are going on in California, due, of course, to El Nino. Have any of those changes affected where you live or anybody that you know?
Well, Chris, I've been very blessed. I got a home in an area that's been safe so far, so good, you know. Good Lord's been looking after me. I live up on a cliff, and it's up high, and it's on a rock foundation, so I haven't had any problems with mudslides or flooding. I've been very fortunate. My roof has been holding out on me here in my house, you know. No leaks or nothing, and I've been very blessed, you know. I tell you, I live at the very southern tip end of Malibu, but if you go up about four or five blocks north from me, that's where the problems begin. I was lucky that I bought a house in this lower part of Malibu, the very southern tip end, because it's the most safest end of Malibu, I think, you know, because the people who live in this area, we've been lucky, we haven't had any problems. But you go up about five blocks up north, going north, starting at Topanga Canyon, and that's where it all primarily begins, right at Topanga Canyon. I notice every year when they have flooding and mudslides and stuff, it always begins at Topanga Canyon upward, up until you go up to the tip-top north end of Malibu. So my prayers are said for those people in that area. You know, they have a lot of problems. But We've been blessed in this area. We haven't had any problems.
One last question, Horace. Are you planning to conduct a tour to support the new CD? And if so, will you bring along the players featured on the new CD?
Well, Chris, I guess you haven't heard about it, but I had to cancel my tour. I had a tour all planned, but I became ill, and I had to cancel my tour. So I'm under doctor's care right now. I'm doing a lot better than what I was before, but I'm not over my problem yet, my physical problem. So I will be planning a tour as soon as I get back to my health. You know, I'm not incapacitated. You know, I'm not confined to bed or anything like that. I'm not in a wheelchair or, thank God, I know, nothing like that. But what I have, my condition is serious enough to warrant me to stay home from off the road until it gets better. So the doctors that work, I got two different doctors I'm seeing, and they're both working on me. And I'm feeling a lot better, but I'm not right yet, you know. So as soon as I get myself together, then I'll plan another tour, you know. But I can't do that right at this very moment. When you said, am I going to bring these same guys on the record out there with me? No, I wouldn't be bringing those guys out there with me. You know, these guys, the Brecker brothers got their own things going. You know, Mike has got his thing going, and Randy's got his thing going. I think Randy won a Grammy this year. I believe he, one of his newest records won a Grammy, or was up for a Grammy, or won a Grammy. And he's got his own thing going. Mike's got his own thing going. Louis Hayes has got his thing going. And Ron Carter's got his thing going. You know, so the group that I had planned to take on the road with me before I had to cancel the tour because of illness was a group of new guys, younger guys from New York City. I can't remember all the guys' names right now. I went to New York City and I auditioned a bunch of young players, players in their 20s or maybe late 20s or mid 20s or whatever, you know, and good players. And some of them were recommended by older musicians, friends of mine, who said, "Well, you check this guy out. He's this young kid can play," you know. And I picked four players, you know, and of course, including myself, makes five. I picked a trumpet, tenor, and bass and drums. And this is the group that I hope to, when I do get myself together physically, when I get back on the road, this is the group that I hope to take on the road with me, because that's the guys that I handpicked them from New York, you know, and was looking forward to making this tour with them. And I still look forward to making this tour with these new young guys, you know, and they're fine young players, and hopefully when I get myself together and we get back on the road again and I can use them and give them a chance to spread their wings and climb the ladder of success, you know, a lot of the guys who went on to be big stars in their own right coming through our group, you know, people like the Brecker Brothers and Tom Harrell and Bob Berg and Joe Henderson and people like that who have come through our band. Well, I want to keep that channel open for these youngsters, you know, so that we can continue to help develop these young players and give them a chance to be seen and heard, and give them the chance to climb the ladder of success. So that's. I hope that answers your question.
Oh, yes.
I wouldn't be coming out there with the guys that are on the record.
Okay, yeah, well, that answers the question very completely. And, again, I wish you all the best of luck with your healing process, and I'm very confident that it will be complete for you, and we look forward to seeing you when you are done with that process.
Well, I know it's just a matter of time, you know. I play that prescription for the blues for myself just about every day. I take my little afternoon walk after my supper. I walk for maybe about 35, 40 minutes, you know, every afternoon for exercise. And invariably, I won't say every day, but most days I play that I have a Walkman on my headset, you know, when I'm uh-huh. taking my exercise walk. And I play a prescription for the blues while I'm walking around, and it makes me feel very good, very happy, and it's got some good rhythms to walk to too. Some of the beats I walk in time with the music, you know, and
it does
kind of makes you walk brisk, and it's nice.